Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Over the past decade, the American presidency has looked and sounded very different than it once did. Now more than ever, long-standing traditions and norms appear to be shifting. There was a time when the president and the office itself was widely respected. That sense of respect and honor has faded amongst some, along with many traditions and standards. Politicians have always used showbiz tactics to gain support, but now more than ever, politicians are using personal attacks in debates, and politics is turning into memes on social media. It all feels a little unserious. Why is this shift occurring, and has the presidency become more casual over time? Joining us to help us better understand what has and hasn't changed historically is Associate Professor and Director of the History Department Symposia Series at Florida Atlantic University, Nicole Anslover. Welcome to All Sides, Nicole.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
So from your understanding and your expertise, is what we're feeling true? Is there a shift in president decorum happening in the past few years?
Certainly. I think we've seen that especially over the past decade, but this is certainly not the only time historically that we've seen such a shift. I like to think of it as there being three main reasons for these shifts in presidential decorum. One is cultural shifts. As society changes, what we expect from the presidency changes and how the person holding that office changes. The second reason for shifts is media and the way that the president is able to connect with the American people. And then the third reason for shifts is quite simply presidential personality or proclivities for doing things a certain way.
So we know we've lived through the past 10 years and we know kind of like this shift. Can you tell me about one in the past that sticks out to you of a shift due to maybe a cultural change?
Sure. Harry Truman actually was responsible for sort of the dressing down of the American president. And although in office, he was always dressed very professionally in a suit and tie, the public was quite surprised when pictures of Truman wearing a Hawaiian shirt while on vacation appeared. And those photos appeared in Life magazine, and people really liked it. And sales of Hawaiian shirts actually went through the roof when this happened in 1951. It was a big deal. And for Truman, it was also intentional as a way to sort of enhance his regular guy image that so many presidents strive for.
I have to think, you know, this shift we're seeing is because of social media, partially at least, or if not a lot. So I would have to think there's been similar shifts then with TV, people or, you know, seeing Truman in the shirt, and then also a shift back whenever radio became more popular. Like before that, all your information was just written down in a newspaper, right? So have those been shifts too?
Absolutely. In the first half of the history of America, basically, Americans weren't really familiar with what their president looked like day to day, and certainly not what they sounded like. Even between Thomas Jefferson and William Howard Taft, the presidents didn't even orally deliver their State of the Union addresses. They just sent in a written report. And Woodrow Wilson was actually the one who brought back the tradition of speaking to Congress and therefore the American people. Wilson was also the first one to hold a press conference. So that was definitely a big shift. And then, of course, we start to see the impact of television in 1960 with the first televised presidential debate between Nixon and Kennedy. And many people were very invested in what the two candidates actually looked like rather than what they sounded like.
So bumping up to modern times, how has social media and the memification of politics kind of, I feel like it's speeded it up more. Like, yeah, everyone talks about what Nixon looked like in that debate versus JFK. But I don't know. I guess the way I'm asking it is like social media is so much faster than that.
So much faster and more wide ranging, right? Mm-hmm. Because people can scroll through their phones wherever they are at whatever time that they want. We're all guilty of some doom scrolling late at night when we come across these things, right? So Barack Obama was really the first social media president. He was the first one to use it intentionally and especially during his campaign. And it really did work to connect him to a wider audience of people, especially young people. And he continued to use social media throughout his presidency. But of course, no one uses it in the way that President Trump does. Mm-hmm. President Trump goes so far as to make major policy statements, to announce major events. And this is completely different than anything we've seen before, when presidents used to hold a press conference or address us from the West Wing or even within the Oval Office. And it seems now that we're getting these major presidential announcements sometimes in the middle of the night, which is hard for many Americans to wrap their minds around.
I guess that leads me to my initial question from the introduction. So is that too casual? Is government like, I not that you're the, you're an expert, but I don't know if you can answer that. Is that too casual to make policy decisions at 2 a.m. on Truth Social?
Well, as a historian, you know, I always ask for, I'm going to need a few years to analyze this. Mm-hmm. But off the top of my head, it totally depends on who you ask, Amy. Some people really like feeling, oh, I'm connected to the president. I can read his thoughts in real time. And then other people are saying this is way too casual. It's informal and it's not decorous, because a lot of these late night posts include sometimes inflammatory words, name calling even. And for many Americans, they like to hold their president to a certain standard. And so whether or not this is extremely effective, we're going to have to see as time goes on and there's more polling done. And basically, we'll see what the legacy of this is.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how presidential traditions have changed over time with Nicole Anslover, history professor at Florida Atlantic University. So let's talk about some of those traditions. Did President Trump and President Biden keep traditions, you know, like the holidays or the inauguration? Have they changed things from what we would have known decades ago for some of the ceremonies? The way that President Trump does ceremonies, I feel, is different than the past.
It does have a different feeling. Part of that is the way that he engages with the press. Part of it is the way that he advertises these things, right? They seem just much more casual in tone, but many of the basic ceremonies themselves have remained. We're still pardoning our turkeys. We are still decorating the White House, even though it sometimes looks different from the more traditional decorations. We are still doing the Easter egg roll. So all of the events, for the most part, are still happening, but in a less formal way. So let me use sports as an example, mm-hmm. right? Traditionally, championship teams get invited to the White House. There's a ceremony, there's some formal words spoken, and then the athletes of whatever team are treated to a very nice meal. And of course, we recall that President Trump has instead chosen to host some of these teams with fast food hamburgers, which seems a step down from the formality of the White House that we've been used to in past years.
Hmm. Now, it can't be that President Trump has single-handedly changed everything, though. So talk to me about more of the evolving over time. Like, President Trump wouldn't be able to be more casual if we hadn't had what happened before.
Certainly. So sort of I'll stay on the theme of food and entertaining for mm-hmm. a minute. One of those major shifts actually came during Lyndon Johnson's time in office. And he surprised the world, actually, by hosting foreign heads of state at his ranch in Texas rather than at the White House. And he threw huge Texas-style barbecues, feeding people ribs, baked beans, corn on the cob, very different from the French fare and the sort of fancy dinners that the Kennedys before him had served. Johnson hosted the president of Mexico at the ranch. He hosted the chancellor of West Germany, leading people to term his style barbecue diplomacy. So, without that sort of more casual take on entertaining, certainly we don't get other casualness coming afterwards.
President Trump's new ballroom and the construction of it has been a source of a lot of discussion about how appropriate it is. So from a historical perspective, is a move like this really unprecedented to want to build a giant ballroom?
Oh, certainly. And it's certainly unprecedented to solicit donations for such a thing. Usually, changing the White House structurally in any way has a very specific process where you need to go through several layers of government bureaucracy to make those changes. So that's absolutely unprecedented and also has a lot of people wondering why, because there have been a lot of beautiful formal occasions at the White House. Think again, Jackie Kennedy and her husband hosting state dinners. The Reagans threw some beautiful balls. So it's definitely not sitting well with a good portion of lawmakers and the American public to get rid of part of the White House and build something new.
So I guess the way he went about it would be the casual part of it. But what he's building is
Right.
certainly not going to be casual because he
Correct.
like so even
Correct.
taking the redecorating of the Oval Office into an example, I wouldn't call all of his gold decorations casual in any way, but his way he went about it maybe is that more casual?
That's definitely more casual. There, like I said, there are procedures in place for a reason, and he has not followed those. But also, even the redecorating with the gold and the removal of certain portraits, certain pieces of furniture, those are typically there for a reason. You know, they have great significance to the American people, or they honor past presidents. And so, replacing some of these things with gold or gilded frames and pieces of art is disconcerting to many. He's certainly not the first to redecorate, but again, I'll go to Jacqueline Kennedy. She did a lot of redecoration, but she invited the American people in. She and her husband very famously aired a television special walking the public through all of the redecorations, all of the choices that were made, why they were made. And so it's very much a matter of this casual approach. And I think it's jarring, especially since, as we just talked about, Trump is a president who seems to put most of his thoughts out on social media for us. And instead, this was not put out for the American people to offer their feedback on.
So, do you feel like President Trump can run things more casually? I don't know if it's because it's him or is it a societal thing? Because we went through COVID, right? There was more work from home. Maybe everyone's a little bit more casual. The corporate world is more casual. There's more people working from home. People realized maybe they didn't have to wear a suit every day. So do you feel like it's happening more because of that societal change?
I don't necessarily think so. I think this is one of those where it's a presidential preference because, you know, think back, it was only a year ago when President Biden was still in office, and there wasn't quite this level of casualness that we're experiencing now in the second Trump administration. So I do think it's not as much a societal change as it is that is his preference for dealing with people.
Over the last three election cycles, presidential debates have become more heated, centered on personal attacks. Does this signal to you a change, a more casual way to go about politics in the presidency?
Absolutely. And my colleagues who study early American history rather than modern, like I do, will tell me, no, you've never seen anything as nasty as the 1800s. But the difference there is that it wasn't public. People were certainly nasty to each other in private, and we can find that in letters and things. But the nastiness, the attacks that we've seen in the past 10 years are new because they're out there and they're public. Other presidents, Nixon wrote notes and spoke to Henry Kissinger and people like that about his anger and what made him mad. But we've now seen candidates talk directly to each other about that on camera. And we've seen presidents fire shots on social media and, like you said, in debates. So this is definitely a 21st century shift that we haven't seen before.
Now, I know you already said that you need a few years in order to answer this question, but taking everything into account that we've talked about, is government overall becoming casual, going to stay more casual, or is this just the current moment in time that we're in and someone else could become president in 2028 or 4 years after that and it could go back to the way things were? Or is this the new norm?
I think it really depends because we also, I'm going to bring a little bit wider scope of government into it. It was only in the 1990s that women in Congress were allowed to wear pants. And it was only in 2017 that women in Congress were allowed to wear sleeveless tops or dresses on the floor. And so definitely we can't say, oh, everything is extremely casual, and it has been for a while, because that only applies to certain people, right? And so I think it depends on who comes into office in the future. And again, like I said, there's these three factors. Mainly, it depends on societal changes, but it doesn't feel like society quite is ready to have a completely casual presidency. And so what we're seeing now, like I said, is a large part of presidential personality. And that will happen the next time we have a presidential election. We'll see who it is. We'll see what their personality is like. And we'll see if there's even more ways for them to connect to the American people.
We've been talking about government and politics becoming more casual with associate professor and director of the History Department Symposia Series at Florida Atlantic University, Nicole Anslover. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Coming up, we're going to talk about communication from Truth Social to TikTok with an expert in political communication. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Truth Social, Instagram, TikTok have all been vessels for political communication and a place for politicians to share their opinions unapologetically. Recently, politicians have made social media platforms their boxing ring with aggressive statements, insults, and misinformation. Is government less formal and more casual because of social media? Joining us now, we have Missouri State University professor and expert in political communication, Brian Ott. Welcome to All Sides, Brian.
Thank you for having me.
So, for decades, political communication was filtered through press briefings, traditional media, but that's no longer the case. So, from your perspective, has social media just completely changed the way government speaks to the public?
Social media has not only changed the way that the government speaks to the public, it's changed the way that we all communicate. And so we live in a completely different world than the one we did 20 years ago with regard to communication.
So tell me about specifically you know, politicians like President Trump using Truth Social to make announcements, to make things that seem like big policy decisions, big statements on foreign policy, just right there on social media instead of having a press conference. How different is that from the past?
It's dramatically different. And the root of why it's different has to do with changes in the technology itself. So I'm a media ecologist, and what that means is I study media environments. Mm-hmm. And specifically, I'm interested in how our changing media environment changes the nature of communication, changes the nature of our culture, but even more fundamentally, it changes the nature of consciousness. So it changes our habits of mind, the ways we think, and our modes of information processing. And we live in obviously a digital world today, and while that's sort of self-apparent probably to everybody, what's less self-apparent is what that means. And digital communication technologies, like all communication technologies, have their own unique structural biases. And we probably don't have time today to talk about all of the structural biases of digital communication technologies, but one of them is informality. And so what this means is that there has been a disappearance of ritual in the nature of our communication today. And so I see this in emails from students all the time, where they just start talking to me in an email, and there's no address at the beginning of an email. It's considered an informal mode of communication, digital technologies. But it turns out that those ritual performances are really, really significant to the way we communicate with one another, and they prompt us to be more civil. And so when you strip communication of those regular ritual performances, you end up making communication less civil. And today, digital media has significantly undermined not only civility, but also rationality, slow thinking, self-reflection, humility, among other things, because of its unique structural biases.
So you as a professor, if a student emails you and says, "Dear Professor Ott, thank you for your time and attention in class. I'm having trouble with the assignment and I need an extension." Would you be more inclined to give the extension if they start the email with, "Hello, professor"?
5 or 10 years ago, I absolutely would have been more inclined to do that. Today, so many of the emails that I get from students are unprofessional, and they come off as curt or rude. I know, but I understand, because I study communication technologies, that they don't intend it that way. So I don't hold it against them today, but that doesn't stop it from having consequence outside in the world, and their professionalism. And so we're really living through one of the greatest paradigm shifts in all of human history in relationship to communication technology. It has fundamentally created an entirely different way that we interact with one another. And the way we interact with one another is far more impulsive. And so, you know, we see this in the president's late night posts on Truth Social, where his communication is highly impulsive, sort of whatever is going through his head ends up online, right? Well, we're all encouraged to communicate like that today. This is not a difficulty or a problem of politics or a difficulty or problem of ideology. It knows no particular ideology.
One of the more bizarre things that happened recently is satirical AI-generated videos being posted. One of them was related to President Trump in Gaza that many found insensitive. But there's two things to talk about here. The first is using AI in political messaging in general, but then the second is making a joke about a very serious matter. So let's start with the first. What do you make of using AI in your political messaging in general?
So I'm going to put this very bluntly, because I think your audience needs to hear this. AI is the most profoundly anti-intellectual technology that human beings have ever created. Beyond that, it may be the most amoral technology that we have ever created. AI is the antithesis of thinking. It literally involves no thought whatsoever. And through digital technologies, one of the points I've been trying to make is that digital technologies condition us, they habituate us, they train us to think like they do, to perform and act the way they do. So the use of AI, because it's not any kind of recognized intelligence, it's not self-conscious, it's not moral, it's not self-aware, right? It invites us to abandon all of those properties in ourselves as humans. So I'm deeply, deeply concerned about the use of AI, not just in politics, but in everything, because one of the other features of our digital environment is that all of our communication, regardless of what it's about today, is in the same scrap heap. So the internet is not organized. It on the surface, it seems like it's organized because you go to a website, or you go to a social media platform, and there's an interface that makes the information look organized. But it's actually not organized. It's just all heaped together in what I like to call a giant river of muck. And so you have indiscriminately moving through that river, you have political communication, you have cat videos, you have postings about vacations, and it's all floating in the same stream. And there's no way to differentiate what is a serious message and what is a serious topic from what is a non-serious topic. It's all participating in the same river. It used to be that this is a particular problem that journalism faces today, because journalism just participates in the same flow of undifferentiated information that everything else participates in today. It used to be that reading a newspaper was a designated activity. People knew when they were consuming the news, because they were sitting in their living room or at their breakfast table, and they had a paper in front of them. And so they were engaged in an activity that was clear what that activity was and what the boundaries of that activity were. But today, journalism mi mixes indiscriminately with all of this other stuff. And so it's almost impossible for users and citizens today to differentiate what is real news and serious news from what is misinformation and disinformation and all of the other stuff that circulates on social media.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how social media has affected formal government and politics with Professor Brian Ott, political communication expert from Missouri State University. Back to that other part of my question was, the second part was making jokes about a very serious matter. Because the theme of this entire hour is casual the new formal? Are we getting more, because we're getting more and more casual. Is it okay to have a politician make a joke about something very serious?
Whether it's okay or not is an ethical question, and I am going to sidestep that question. What I am going to say with absolute clarity is that it is inevitable in our current media environment. Because of the non-hierarchical and decentered nature of digital communication, everything on social media becomes about self-production and self-performance. And the currency of the realm, particularly on social media, is attention seeking. So the goal is to be seen. The goal is to garner attention, because you have to cut through all of the other stuff that's in the river of muck. And here's what we know: norm violation, negative emotion travel further and faster online. Basically, they garner more attention. And so our president is a notorious rule breaker, right? But what he really has done is capitalized on the biases of the platform of social media themselves, which is all of the people who are famous on social media are really norm breakers, because they say outrageous things in part to make sure that they have an audience.
When I was researching this topic, I came across a New York Times article, and it was called The Memification of American Politics. And it went through how both Presidents Biden and President Trump have become memes and also laughingstocks. So the article mentions that these memes end up fueling decisions on how people vote. How concerned should we be about a meme influencing an election?
We should be seriously concerned about memes influencing election. We should be seriously concerned about the way digital media generally is influencing our entire political structure. Here's the part that both the left and the right entirely get wrong. I think they're delusional about this, both sides of the political spectrum. They think that this is a battle over ideology. It is not. It is a
Oh, I think that we lost Brian for a second. He froze. Maybe he can, maybe we can keep buffering. otherwise, we're going to have to give him a call. He was making a really good point at that moment, yes, but he is now definitely frozen. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we are talking about how social media has affected formal government. Our guest is Brian Ott, political communications expert from Missouri State University. Oh, you're back with us, Brian. You were making such a good point. So can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. So just back up a couple of sentences and go ahead with what you're saying.
So the difficulty, the problem today is not one of ideology. It's a problem of epistemology. They're simple concepts packaged in familiar and friendly and often funny image packages, right? That's really what a meme is. And they're intended to go viral, not to actually be deliberative. But this, again, is the bias of digital media technologies. Digital media technologies do not foster deliberation. They structurally inhibit rational thought, rational deliberation, careful argument, slow thinking. All of the things that are essential to democracy are undermined by our use of digital media platforms in politics.
And Brian, I'm going to ask you to turn your video off. That way we have a few more minutes in our interview, and that'll help with the buffering problem we are having. But stay here with us with the sound. There we go. So another person I wanted to ask you about is Zoran Mamdani. He just won the mayoral election in New York City, and he has fans all over the world for his online presence, which is humorous. So I can see a case where social media political campaigns are beneficial, right? So what makes his approach different than others who have been memeified when we're talking about like people making fun of President Biden with these memes, but then Mamdani in New York City can be humorous and it's seen in a different way? Is he doing it right?
I don't think there is any right to memes. I don't think there's any rights. There may be a popularity factor. But here's what we know about digital communication and the way it's transforming our politics. It's not making us more politically divided. Political division is not new. It's certainly not new in the last 20 years. It has a long, long history in this country. But not only do we suffer from political division today, we suffer from affective division. And this is chartable, it's measurable, it's about an emotional quotient. And what we know today is that people don't simply disagree with people on the other end of the political spectrum, they actually dislike and hate those people. Mm-hmm. This is called affective polarization. And affective polarization is on the rise. And it's absolutely driving out of our conversation and deliberation middle ground, which is probably where most U.S. Americans actually are intellectually, is somewhere in the middle, but they have no voice online.
And it's pretty obvious social media is here to stay. This is the way we're going to communicate going into the future, even as AI changes it. So where do we draw the line between this making politics and our government more approachable, more casual, versus upholding behavioral standards? How do we balance those two things?
Well, so one of the things that I would love, so there's a couple of things I think we need to do. And one of the things I think we need to do is we need to educate our citizenry more effectively about the profound paradigm shift that is taking place and the consequences of our use of digital technologies. Let me make a really specific point here. Because every communication technology has inherent structural biases, that means some technologies are good at doing some things and bad at doing other things. Let's take a really simple technology. Let's take a tool, as a matter of fact, a hammer. A hammer is engineered, it is structurally engineered to concentrate a tremendous amount of force in a very tiny area. So that makes a hammer really good at smashing things. It makes a hammer really good at pounding things, but it makes a hammer lousy at washing windows. We entered the digital era believing incorrectly, delusionally, that digital media could do anything analog media could do, and they could do it better. It's foolishness. It is absolute foolishness. And if we don't course correct, we are significantly undermining sociality And we're not going to be able to maintain a civil social sphere if we don't make some kind of major course correction.
Well, that sounds like another show on the social media, the people who own the social media companies and what they're showing us. So we're going to leave it there. We've been talking about social media making government and politics less formal and more casual with Missouri State University professor and expert in political communication, Brian Ott. Thank you so much for your time, Brian.
My pleasure.
Coming up, we're going to talk about another aspect of politics and government that is more casual than it used to be, dress codes. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. As our political climate becomes more polarized and our behavioral standards change, there's an aspect of our government that's becoming more casual that we might have missed: dress codes. To help us learn more about how fashion has evolved in politics, we have with us the founding director of the Institute for Public Humanities and the Arts at Hofstra University and fashion expert, Rhonda Gerlich. Welcome to the show. Oh, you're muted, Rhonda. Yeah, sorry about that. There you go. There you go. Welcome to the show, Rhonda.
Thanks, Amy. Hello.
So tell us about what the general dress codes have been traditionally for government officials. When you think about a dress code in the government, I think suit and tie. Was that ever formally written down like there is a dress code?
I think it has been a matter of practice for 100 years or more, and nobody needed to question it so long as only men, and usually men of a certain class and ethnicity, were in the government. And over time, slowly, as other folks joined the government, I think they hewed generally to as close a look to that as possible, especially in the case of women, for whom the code, the sort of unwritten code for women, well, actually the formal code for women for years up until the 90s, when I think it was broken, was skirts for women in Congress. And then some women put on pants and scandalized everyone, apparently, in the 90s. And then it became more normal. It's hard to believe it was as recently as that, right? And then, of course, most recently, as we all know, the Senate relaxed its rules initially for Senator John Fetterman, who felt more comfortable in his hoodie and long shorts. And that caused another brouhaha. But it has always been, regardless of what's written down, for women in particular, any kind of dress code is always problematic for the simple reason that we have so many, many choices, none of which invisibilizes us, none of which makes us uniform for many very old historic reasons.
So was it true that to make a speech on the House or Senate floor for a time, you had to have on a suit and tie? A woman had to be in a skirt with like a jacket. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. So now, but now you're saying because of John Fetterman, can you make a speech on the Senate floor not in a suit and tie?
Yes, you can. Although whether anyone will or I don't, Fetterman has, I believe, but I don't think anyone else has, and it would be ill-advised. And I actually didn't love when they relaxed the dress codes because I think it harms women in particular. Just think about it. If you see a man in a polo shirt and chinos on a casual Friday at work, for example, you don't assume that he is slovenly or can't do his job. You assume that he has a golf date after work, perhaps, and it suggests athleticism or comfort with oneself. If you saw a woman in Lululemon at work, you would think, well, I would not, but there are those who would think, Does she not know where she is? Is she not respecting the environment? Is she an unserious, frivolous person who cares more about body than mind? And that's because women are always in the great dichotomy of things. Women are body and men are mind, sort of conceptually. And so there's almost nothing a woman can wear casually, which puts her on the same footing as men. And then there's also the sort of class issue. If within a body like Congress, especially the Senate, which is the most august, supposedly, legislative body, if all of the senators suddenly start cashing it up, right? That will not apply to all the many other people who work with them, the pages, the staff members, security. They will all be wearing what they normally wear, which is far more formalized. But then, in contrast to a bunch of folks in golf and yoga wear, those folks will start to look like liveried servants. And that will simply once again reintroduce this almost caste system because it's all contextual, right? What we wear has no meaning without what everyone else wears. It's like language.
So over time, dress codes have loosened. We were talking about, them even loosening for the Senate floor, but some say it's to make politics more relatable, to make politicians more relatable to the public. And some say it's an effect on this post-COVID workplace standards, where people realized that they can work from home and they can go into work and don't have to be in a full suit. How do you feel about that? Do you think it's to make politics relatable, or do you think we're in a post-COVID world and people are less formal?
I've thought a lot about this. In some ways, I think COVID was very illuminating because it taught us something important. Here's an upside that I think happened in the wake of COVID, which is that we all had to learn that we are a collective organism. That is to say, we needed to wear masks because what I breathe out, you breathe in, and we are shared organically, biologically, even by our shared space. That's profound and that unites us. And I kind of hoped that that would create more of a united feeling, but it had, unfortunately, somewhat of the opposite effect. I think, yes, we're in a more casual realm because of this kind of communication that you and I are having right now. We're on Zoom. However, for institutions like the government, anything that is a collective symbolic body, I think it is in no way helpful to have everyone do their own thing because that fractures the collectivity. If you think of a church choir or a sports team or the Supreme Court, even despite its riven nature right now, visually they are in uniform or a version of that. In order to remind us that they are not just atomized individuals, they are greater than the sum of their parts. They are a collective body, a social or a national body. If you start breaking that up into little atomized pieces in the name of leisure or comfort, I do not think that's relatable at all. I don't want to relate to my senator as somebody who looks like I might go have, a drink at the club or go out jogging with him right this minute. I want to know that my senator is part of a collectivity that's working together to help all of us, not is my buddy. And I think there are, there's a time and a place for everything. And I think it's mistaken to think of any kind of elegant similarity. And it's not a uniform like Boy Scouts uniforms. Any kind of routinized, elegant, similar visuality is actually helpful.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about government dress codes becoming more casual with fashion expert and arts and humanities professor Rhonda Gerlich. So, some might disagree with what you say about the dress codes. Like, it doesn't matter what you wear as long as you have the power. So an example of this would be President Trump himself. The tailoring of his suits has come into question. He's seen wearing a baseball cap a lot. So what do you think, or why do you think it's accepted for him to dress the way he does, wearing a baseball cap in the Oval Office?
So this is a whole other thing. First of all, I would say that President Trump, despite the cap, which I'll get to in a minute, is not that differently dressed. In fact, he's in some ways more formally dressed than almost any president in my lifetime. He is almost never seen without a suit and tie. The only times we see him without one are when he is golfing, and that's an appropriate place for golf attire. And every president I can remember has had some kind of sporting weekend look, where we're supposed to understand they're relatable, regular people having fun. The baseball cap is now is not, he's not advertising or promoting his favorite team. He isn't. I can't recall him ever saying he follows sports or is, rooting for the Mets or something. His baseball cap says MAGA on it, or Make America Great Again, and that is a symbolic communication to his base that is as powerful as an emblazoned t-shirt or any number of other things people wear to show solidarity. So it's another kind of uniform. And it is in dissonance, you're correct, with his suit, but it is not out of keeping with a language that he speaks. It's his way of communicating beyond the formality, which is generic of the Oval Office, the suit and tie, although one could discuss the strange length of the tie and so forth. We all know that it's not quite standard issue, but whatever. The hat is like a not secret, but it's a tacit gesture to a whole other realm. And it is part of a uniform.
In the spring, many people questioned the Ukrainian president Zelensky for not wearing a suit to his meeting in the Oval Office. How should we navigate a dress code in that kind of situation? Like, does it matter that he didn't have a suit on in that Oval Office meeting?
Oh, yes. Actually, there's a chapter in my new book about this very moment. When President Zelensky showed up, he was wearing neither a business suit nor technically a military uniform. What he was wearing was a quarter zip sweat shirt and kind of camo pants or cargo pants, but they were of a look that immediately telegraphs military. And Zelensky has been, since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, Zelensky has made a point of going around the world when he meets with the highest leaders of every country, and when he addressed the UN, he wears military style clothing. And the reason is he's expressing solidarity with his people who are under siege, and he is showing that he's actually said, "I will wear a suit when the war is over." When he was attacked by our government officials for appearing out of a business suit, they said this is disrespectful. The fact is, every single person who said that knew perfectly well that that's how Zelensky would show up. They had seen him show up like that before. He had met with Biden in the Oval Office exactly the same way. And in fact, Zelensky was referring, I don't know if he probably knows this because he's a pretty smart guy, this tradition of wearing military style clothes during your country's wartime was begun by Winston Churchill, who during World War II would show up at events in a kind of flight jumpsuit, which was what people wore in air raid shelters to protect themselves. So he would meet with world leaders in this outfit to say specifically, "I am here, but my heart and my soul are with my people who are under siege." What was also fascinating, Amy, about that particular event that you speak of is that every single other person in the Oval Office, and they were virtually all men, certainly all the officials were men, were wearing business suits. And that became almost a uniform. That is to say, we think of business suits as normal civilian wear, Zelensky being the one who is out of uniform, that turned all of them into uniformed people and him into the ununiformed one, even though what he was wearing actually looked most like a military uniform, which further proves that there is no base standard for how we interpret dress. It is always contextual and it can flip in a second.
Recently, when Mamdani won the mayoral race in New York City, he became known during that campaign for always wearing a suit. But his suit's not anything fancy, but it's the fact that he was wearing one. So, does what officials wear, does it have to be expensive and fitted and tailored, or does it just have to be a suit?
That is such a hard question. I love that question. There, it doesn't have to be anything, but everything it is will tell a story. And some of what it tells is only communicated very sub rosa and sometimes only to certain groups of people. So, for example, when AOC famously wore that dress to the Met Gala that said tax the rich, some people thought it was brilliant and some people were angry. But those people who understood it was a couture dress also could complicate their understanding by saying, well, it says one kind of populist slogan, but it's a multi tens of thousand dollar gown. Even if she didn't buy it, that's telegraphing a conflictual message. Many people sense when someone is extremely well tailored, even if they don't think about it. And for some of us, that can mean, oh, that person has good taste. For others of us, it can mean that person spent more than I want them to spend. I want them frugal and, you know, enacting policies of frugality on my behalf. There's not one answer, but I will say that there's a difference between men and women. Again, I think men can get away with looking a lot more slapped together sartorially. And women, regardless of what financial status they're conveying, are frankly held to a different standard if anything looks visually out of place or ill-sewn or messy.
We've been talking about the government becoming more casual, and we've been talking about dress codes. I want to say thank you to the founding director of the Institute for Public Humanities and the Arts at Hofstra University and fashion expert Rhonda Gerlich. Thank you so much for your time, Rhonda.
Thank you, Amy.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. I want to say thank you to our staff. We have producers Marcus Charleston and Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, and our student producers Izza Huck, Colin Simpson, and Kiara Burson. And a special thank you to Izza Huck for producing this show today. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.